Welcome to The Upper Hand, where Chuck and Chris talk hand surgery.
We are two hand surgeons at Washington University in St. Louis, here to talk about all aspects of hand surgery, from technical to personal.
Thank you for subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
And be sure to leave a review. That helps us get the word out.
Oh, hey, Chris.
Hey, Chuck. How are you?
I'm good. It's always good to be back with you on the pod.
I know. It's so fun. It's so fun. Nothing like starting early on a Saturday morning.
Absolutely. It's so easy to find the time to do this.
Exactly. Well, you know, I just finished rounding and, you know, the joy of doing that, that was fun. And, you know, I'm excited to talk about a couple of cases I have.
I am looking forward to these. You've given me a little bit of a teaser and, you know, what's better than talking about nerve? I did hear, I should say to you, unfortunately, I missed your resident interactive on Thursday morning. Unfortunately, I'm always double booked and so rarely get to those. But I heard that it was outstanding, not surprising. And when I said, well, what was the topic? I said that only tongue in cheek because I knew what the topic was.
You know, when you, so for those of you that are not familiar with how we do our curriculum here, we have core lectures, which are didactic. So, you know, the faculty will give a talk about, I don't know, carpal tunnel syndrome or nerve injury or something along those lines. And then that's complemented by, I think it's maybe 50-50, maybe not exactly 50-50, but interactive sessions where the faculty will just present cases and it is Socratic, I guess is the nice way to say it. But you know, it's interactive. I mean, so you can, you know, I think some of us have a little more fun with that than others. But I love giving interactives because it makes me obviously one of the, anybody that's trained with me knows that I take a lot of pictures, and this is the reason, is that the pictures and, you know, the x-rays make a huge difference in how these cases are presented. So I'm glad you heard it went well, because actually that's one of the cases we're going to talk about today.
I love it. Before we do that, let me share my experience from yesterday, which was different. As you know, I'm an academic guy. I've been in academics my whole life. I'm usually fortunate to have at least one trainee. And honestly, I don't, as we've discussed, I don't like more than one trainee. I just like to, but sometimes we have more than one trainee and it's a great model. And we're a little short, so to speak, right now with trainees for a variety of reasons. And so I operated solo with what I thought were a couple of pretty straightforward cases at Children's Hospital. And then I had another one where one of the more senior residents came over and joined me who I've not been currently working with. But the children's cases were interesting because they weren't straightforward. And it was me and an ENT nurse who was scrub slash assisting using a drill. And, you know, those are challenges that in academics we don't usually face. And it was interesting. End result, great for both cases. Frustration level, moderate. But it just reminds me of how fortunate I am in many respects and how much I like what I do. I know private practice would be great. And certainly there's resourcing in private practice, which can be really good. But it was just it was an eye-opening experience.
Right. When you're used to having either you yourself being able to do the retraction and having somebody else do the more technical or mechanical parts of the case, or, you know, having somebody retract for you while you do the more technically challenging parts, it's definitely different. I mean, I think that when I started as faculty, I wondered why there were certain times in the week where nobody had clinical commitments typically. So like Friday afternoon, our fellows have their clinic and that they primarily staff and we go there now. And the residents go too, but I wondered why nobody would have clinic on Friday afternoon or have surgeries on a Friday afternoon. And then I realized why, yeah. But you know, I do my clinic on Friday afternoons alone. And I keep telling myself I need to change a template so that there aren't as many new patients. Because I'm sitting there seeing all these tons of new patients on my own on Friday afternoons. And obviously I'm with a therapist, and that's fantastic, but no trainee, which means all dictations go to me and all the kind of first wave of seeing the patients and all that kind of stuff. And it's great. Patients love Friday afternoon appointments, which is why I keep doing it. But now I realize why nobody else sees patients Friday afternoon.
Two things, Chris, two things. First, for the students and residents and fellows listening, that is a pearl. Friday afternoon clinics are gold. And I did one for 10 years. There are obviously some negatives to it, but patients love it. And you will get busy on Friday afternoon. Now, Monday and Tuesday have their benefits as well from weekend falls, et cetera. That's gold. Briefly, because I know people don't want to just hear about nerve, but let me tell you briefly what the cases were, because they were kind of both cool. So the first one was a, you know, adolescent who was in an altercation, missed his punch, hit the wall, and essentially, to make a long story short, had a non-dislocated but significantly subluxated thumb MCP joint with a radial collateral ligament avulsion from proximally. So It was impressive, not treated in an outside hospital, got to me and brought him to the OR. And, you know, very satisfying result. I did pin the joint, which I don't usually do with the collateral ligament, but this was a very different type of collateral ligament.
That is weird. I'm just trying to think mechanically how that happens in terms of when you miss a punch, but I mean,
I guess he must have struck the radial part of his thumb against the wall.
Yeah. Wow. That's a crazy injury.
Yeah.
Let me guess, suture tape augmentation as well.
No, actually not. I pinned the joint, as I said, and I'll leave that in for 5 weeks. And I got a great suture anchor repair of a robust ligament from the metacarpal head. And again, for those of you who don't do a lot of these, you know, on the ulnar side, it's literally almost always from distal base of P1. Mm-hmm. From the radial side, Luke Catalano, demonstrated this about a third, and this was one of the proximal avulsions. So great repair. I think that, you know, he'll do great. The second case was even harder. For those who do any peds, you know what the subcondylar P1 fracture is. It's really the distal proximal phalanx fracture right below the joint surface. And what typically happens is they tilt a little dorsally, and, you know, some of them have a chance to remodel, some don't. But the reduction's no big deal. You get it back in place, you put a couple pins in, patients do great. This one was off about 120 degrees. So it was unbelievable how displaced it was. And it had been out in that position for 10 days, and it was really challenging to get back in place. And part of the challenge is the risk of avascular necrosis of that fragment. And so detaching soft tissues is a no-no. Which was really tempting to do to try to ease the reduction, you know, and the ENT nurse did a great job and we got through it. And all that matters is it looks good now.
Those are tough. My stomach turns every time I see those cases, and I really hope that you're in town or Dr. Lindley Wall's in town when those cases come up. Like, you know, I think this might be better off with one of our peds specialists. How real is that risk of avascular necrosis of the fragment? I know it's a concern. Having not seen it go south, how often does that happen if somebody comes in from outside?
You know, what's interesting is more and more, and this goes for supracondylar humerus fractures and little fractures like this, these are not taken care of by people who don't know what they're doing, which is, again, I'm biased, but that's the right thing. And resourcing and travel and all those things matter. I think it's one of those situations where it's the magnitude of the complication, so to speak, rather than its frequency that scares the heck out of me. I've seen it once in my career, and, you know, it's just, there's no fix for it. There's no fix for it. It's devastating in a young patient to have that fragment die. So I have not seen it. Maybe seen it more than once, but I think once was on a patient I had operated on maybe 15 years ago. And I don't know what I did wrong, if anything, but tough outcome.
Once is enough.
Once is enough. All right. I know you're itching to talk nerve. Hit me.
Hey, you know, it's interesting. I've been in this run of, I think I have 4 presentations to give in 10 days. And I don't know how that happened, but I had to make a new talk for our sports colleagues. So it was nerve injuries in athletes, which I really didn't want to have to make a completely new talk, but I also don't like phoning it in on presentations. So I put the time into making that talk, and then I gave the presentation that we talked about before for the California Hand Therapy Group, which was really fun to do, presented alongside my therapy colleague, Jamie Findice. So that was another talk to put together. Those were literally back-to-back days, back-to-back mornings. And then I had this resident interactive to put together for this week. And then I'm co-presenting our core lecture on brachial plexus with Lindley Wall on Tuesday. So it's just a lot of presentations. But this case was really fun because it happened to come in pretty timely. Maybe we could talk a little bit about when patients don't do well after carpal tunnel release. So
super fun topic.
Right. Well, because everybody does well with carpal tunnel, right? Slam dunk. It's a layup. Yeah. So, I mean, because this surgery should go well 100% of the time, which is a very high bar for a carpal tunnel release. So this patient came in his 50s, found his...
Sorry, let me interrupt you. Mm-hmm. I guess in the back of my mind, I agree this surgery should go well 100% of the time, depending on checking a lot of boxes and reasonable expectations. I would never say that to a patient.
I agree. I'd never tell that to a patient, but I think in my mind, if you're going to do a carpal tunnel release, the expectation is that technically you're going to execute it perfectly every time. Yep. Now you may take a little longer to get there. Everybody does it differently, et cetera. But yeah, I agree with you on that. So patient's in his 50s, came to me about a year out from his original surgery. He had a carpal tunnel release done elsewhere. And he said it took a while, but about, you know, 2 or 3 weeks later, he started having just this worsening kind of shooting pain. And he said it was like an ice pick in, you know, to his middle and his ring finger. So how do you start to think about that patient?
So I'm sorry, tell me exactly when it started.
So it started 2 weeks after his surgery.
So initially he was fine.
Initially, well, he didn't mention it to anybody. Let's put it that way.
Okay. And
this is the history that he gave us, is that a couple of weeks later, it just, you know, really, really hurt. And then, you know, it's burning and shooting and, you know, ice pick kind of pain, middle and ring finger.
Yeah. So, interesting, you know, I do some medical legal review, and we've talked about that. And I do think it's important for us to be involved in that community. Therefore, I've had the chance to review some different reports of patients with nerve injury after carpal tunnel. And my experience has been most of them have an immediate, clear lack of a good result. When they wake up from surgery, or at that first post-operative visit, it is obvious that something's not right. Swelling, pain, shooting pain, numbness, it runs the gamut. This is a little different, but it is what it is. You know, reports suggest that the most common injury in a carpal tunnel is to the comedigital nerve, to the ring and middle. And gosh, this sounds sort of like it.
Yeah, no, that's, you know, obviously the alarm bells start going off when you hear that, but the timeline just sounds weird, right? It's not, and then again, like not everybody reads the textbook. So that's the thing I start to think about. And then he's got a Tinel sign, and his Tinel sign is, so he had he's a, you know, kind of a bigger hand. So he had a reasonable size incision. It was not a mini open. It was an open carpal tunnel release. So a healthy size incision. But, you know, it didn't really get, you know, very far between, like, you know, beyond the distal aspect of that thenar hypothenar confluence. So incision ended here. He had a Tinel sign here. So when I'm pointing, for those of you that aren't on YouTube, it's about, you know, right around the DPC area, probably about 2 centimeters proximal to the third web space.
So I'm scratching my bald head. And so you pointed to the incision ending in an appropriate spot, relatively, you know, close to the superficial palmar arch. And yet his Tinel's begins at least 1 centimeter, if not 2 centimeters, distal to that.
Correct.
Whoa. All right. So I guess my initial thought is, well, that couldn't have been an injury from surgery. It's just too far away.
Right. I mean, because no matter your technique, I mean, nobody's reaching that far through that incision. And obviously the palmar arch is in between. So if you're going to injure something, you probably would have injured the palmar arch along the way too. So then his thenars are perfect. No atrophy. His 2-point discrimination is elevated. It's greater than 15 for the for, of course, the third web space distribution. So again, that is consistent with what you would think a third web space nerve injury. But here's the other thing on his exam. So he's got at the proximal end of his incision, just proximal to the incision. His incision ends at the palm, at the wrist crease on the palmar side. He's got a very hot Durkin's test or compressive provocative test there. If you tap on it, it obviously hurts. If you push on it, it reproduces his symptoms in his ring and small or his middle and ring finger.
Still confusing, but I guess that would make a little more sense that, and I would be suspicious of a nerve injury at that level with a weird distal radiation of symptoms. That would be my takeaway. And I can keep going, but I'll stop there and see where you want to take me on this journey.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that the way that I think about this, there's a nice review article that was written by some of our plastics colleagues here, Tommy Tung and Susan McKinnon, I think it was in the early 2000s. And the way that they think about symptoms after carpal tunnel releases that don't go well, and are the symptoms persistent? Are they recurrent? Are they new or worsening? And if the symptoms are persistent, then maybe you had the wrong diagnosis or it was an incomplete release. So wrong diagnosis, not necessarily that they didn't have a carpal tunnel, but maybe there was something you missed proximally. So either in the forearm, less likely the thoracic outlet, and then obviously the cervical spine is the thing that I think about. So, and then if it's recurrent, you worry about maybe it, either the transverse carpal ligament reformed or it wasn't a complete release again. That also falls in there. And then if, as you astutely mentioned, if the symptoms are new or worsening, then you worry about a nerve injury. So median nerve and the proximal forearm was not provocative. C-spine was fine. I actually got into the habit of just getting a single AP view of the elbow to make sure there isn't a supraconnular process and a ligament of Struthers. Just,
damn, you are an academician.
Hey, but because when I see it, I really want a great picture. So
I'll share with you.
I am searching. I think the only time that I've actually seen it is an iPhone picture of an x-ray that a fellow took in your clinic.
My gift to you will be a beautiful picture of a supraconylar process. I'm going to find
it. But the thing is, it's not the same when I have to say this picture is from Chuck Goldfarb. It's got to be mine, you know?
Fair enough.
So then on his exam, as you go into the mid, so, you know, going from the mid forearm and distally, the tenelles doesn't really pick up until kind of right proximal to the incision. So I'm thinking what you're thinking. What testing would you get at this point? You've done an exam. You've got pretty compelling findings on your exam. Would you get any additional testing? Are you going straight to the OR? How do you talk to this patient?
No testing. Straight to the OR sooner rather than later. I think time is not our friend here. Scarring is not our friend. The chances of an MRI or ultrasound showing something helpful is just not that good, in my opinion. And I'm not against those tests. But if they show something, you're going to the OR. If they don't show something, you're going to the OR. And I would go straight to the OR sooner rather than later.
Does it change your counseling or your surgical planning or your surgical booking if you have additional information?
No.
How long, what are you going to tell this patient that you're going to do? And then how long are you booking the case for? And where are you booking it?
Well, yeah, those are all really good questions, but let me back up because I stood on my soapbox really tall and said straight to the OR. It is
like the stack of boxes you have behind you. It looks like you're moving in, Chuck.
Or moving out. Careful. I think it's really important. If it's my patient and I think I did everything well, I'm probably doing testing, just being totally honest.
Right.
It is far easier to go to the operating room if it's not my patient.
Right, right.
So that's number one. Number two, this is not a case I do in the midst of my normal, crazy, busy surgical primary day. This is a case booked separately, booked generously. And I guess for this one, I would probably book it for an hour and a half to 2 hours, have an operating microscope available, and, you know, look forward to an interesting, challenging case.
So when I presented this, the slide says, you know, I presented this at the resident conference, the slide says carpal tunnel done at OSH. And it is easier when it's done at OSH. And I remember as an intern, we were presenting cases in trauma conference or something. And one of the medical students was like, where is this OSH? Like, everything happens at OSH.
I'm like, the bad
outside place. Hospital, outside hospital, never go to the outside hospital. I agree with the threshold for testing is different if it's your own patient and I don't remember every carpal tunnel release, but we typically have a sense of when things aren't, you know, what you would expect intraoperatively. Would you get a nerve test? Because I think a lot of people, if you pulled them, would get some nerve studies. Would they help you in this setting?
I don't think they help me. And again, I think time is my enemy, so I would not. Would you?
You mentioned medical legal work. Do you think that a nerve study is necessary in the setting of, you know, because some people get nerve studies before surgery just for this reason. If things don't go well, they have something to fall back on. Would you get a nerve study post-op? Is that helpful in somebody not doing well?
Well, there's a couple of factors. One, what's the timing of, you know, the nerve study compared to the potential injury, obviously. And I will say the medical legal question is not wrong. I've seen a case where the initial surgeon blamed the revision surgeon for the injury, which is fascinating. But no, I think a careful clinical documentation of your exam preoperatively and supplemented with a careful documentation of intraoperative findings, potentially with pictures, is what I would do in this short time frame. If it's 6 months out, it's a very different story. And in that point, I definitely would get nerve studies. But in a more acute setting where I really want to get to the OR, I would not.
So, I mean, he is almost a year out from his initial surgery and actually came in with nerve studies done elsewhere, which, guess what, showed moderate carpal tunnel syndrome. Wow. So, you know, I don't expect the nerve studies to normalize. I didn't push, you know, trying to get new studies. It would not have changed one thing for me. MRI, I think imaging the nerve, I disagree with you. I think imaging the nerve is useful because we've got a Tinel sign that is distal in the web space, but you got a provocative test somewhere else. So in this particular case, I think imaging is useful.
Listen, I'm not here to question your knowledge of MRI and nerve, but why? You're going to see nothing. You're going to see scar.
So you've got a Tinel out here,
uh-huh,
and you've got a provocative test in the palm. Are you going to cut them open the entire length, or are you only going to go to one place first and then try to figure out where else to go?
I'm starting with an extended carpal tunnel release. But honestly, this guy probably does deserve a longer incision and exploration of both sites.
So I wanted an ultrasound mainly to query for the third web space branch, because he's got a Tinel's there. Now, I think it's almost impossible to get to the third web space, the area where his Tinel is, from the distal end of his incision, but you never know. So to me, an ultrasound was helpful there to ensure that there wasn't any enlargement of that nerve at a focal point in the distal aspect of the palm. Because we're talking, it's distal to the where you would make a trigger incision. So I wanted to make sure I wasn't going to have to go there, because I think the nerve was going to, my thought was that the nerve was injured at the base of the, at the base of the palm, or there was an incomplete release. So that to me helps inform what I do in the operating room. So we got it. Oh, go ahead.
So ultrasound, not MRI.
Ultrasound. I think ultrasound is way better.
Good. Perfect. I agree with that.
It's a better assessment. It's, you know, it costs less. I think it's better for everybody. It's a dynamic assessment too.
And? Drum roll.
So bifid median nerve, which we can talk about that maybe on another episode about how that may change what you do. Third web space branch, totally fine. Everything distal to the incision, totally fine. So that helps me, because then I can focus my efforts in surgery and then in counseling the patient on working in his prior incision and just proximal. So agree. The other thing, the bifid median nerve, the radial side was completely fine. It was uniform in its diameter. You know, from the distal forearm into the incision, but the ulnar side had focal enlargement, which is super interesting. So the ulnar side was 4 centimeters in the distal forearm. And then as you go distally, it's 18. So it's enlarged. So clearly there is something going on there. It was called as, or 18 millimeters, excuse me, not 18 centimeters, but it was called as, yeah, it's like huge. One of your carpal tunnel patients,
and
your syndromic folks. So, and they called it consistent with an aroma. So that to me is super useful in terms of counseling, super useful in terms of surgical planning.
I agree. For the record, you are right.
No, that's okay. You can go about just booking your surgery and hoping, you know, so that you're going to finish early. You'll have found time. I bet you'll be kicking yourself that you finished earlier and couldn't put on another case or whatever. But I mean, your booking is absolutely right in terms of, you know, but I consented him for a revision, carpal tunnel release, a median neurolysis, and a possible nerve allograft. Would you have talked to him about an autograft?
Yeah, this is the discussion I had with the trainee who loved your lecture. I don't know the answer to that. You have great confidence in allograft. You use it regularly. The science seems to support it. I still hesitate, I guess, just because of my biases and I would lean towards autograft. I would.
You know, cut this guy's leg open?
Sure. Do it all the time.
Do you like MABC in this setting? I mean, I don't like taking nerves that tend to be provocative in terms of CRPS type things or, you know, causalgic nerves, so to say.
Yeah, I would not. I would go to the lower extremity and use sural if I thought. It depends on what the deficit looked like and other factors. I like you have taught me that allograft is a very effective option. And so I would certainly strongly consider that. I might lean in this case towards an autograft.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the literature supports in a gap that is under 5 centimeters in a sensory only nerve, which we believe it is the ulnar side. Maybe there's some innervation to the lumbricals, but usually that comes off on the radial side. To me, this is a nice case for an allograft. So while I saved money on the ultrasound, I spent money on the allograft. Yeah. So when we get in there, it was enlarged, as you would expect. It was thick. And it didn't handle like a normal nerve. And there was definitely a zone of transition on that nerve proximal compared to distal. And I didn't think it looked right. I was like, maybe this is just, you know, a nerve injury in continuity. Maybe it's an axonomic injury. But let's just be sure. Let's get the microscope out and do an internal neurolysis of that component, the ulnar side. We got the scope out and it was like this. You know, there was definitely a clear discontinuity of the nerve, which... to me, it's like, well, all right, I guess I'm glad we got the microscope out. I'm glad we did it. I was really hoping, obviously, it's easier to not have to do something like that. But then we started cutting back. And, you know, cutting back to healthy nerve was kind of a big thing for this patient. We had to cut back more than we thought.
Yeah, that to me is the hard part, right? I mean, you have to be, you know, obviously protecting the good part of the nerve, which may have been easier if this was truly a laceration of the entire ulnar bifid portion. But when it's not, you're protecting the good part of the nerve, you're cutting back on the damaged part of the nerve. And, you know, it's a little easier if you already know you need a graft, but that's tricky and you want beautiful bulging fascicles.
So yeah, it was ended up being just under a 3 centimeter gap. I think it's interesting. I don't know how many of the surgeons that are listening have used the acellular nerve allograft, in the US it's made here by Axygen. The way that they, what size would you have asked for, just out of curiosity, in terms of diameter?
And you said entering the carpal tunnel is 4 millimeters.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you're not going to, there's still going to be edema and enlargement distally, even after you do your resection. So I would have had a couple available. I guess I would have had a 4 millimeter, but probably double or triple that as well. I don't know.
Yeah. So, I mean, the one that was available to me, I had asked for a 2 to 3, just before the ultrasound, because I'd booked the case before the ultrasound was back. And it's interesting, the diameters can vary greatly because it is a 2 to 3. So you could be getting like a 1.9, you could be getting a 3.5 or, you know, a 3.9. It ended up being that I booked for a longer graft just because, Dr. McKinnon taught me that, you know, the incremental cost of the graft is not that big. If you end up needing a 7, I usually just have 7s in the freezer in terms of length. And so we ended up using a 2 to 3, but then cutting it in half and using, you know, double strands, which technically is a bit of a pain in the butt. I wish I just booked for a larger one, but that's what was available. So we ended up using that and doing the repair. To me, I try to do this with the wrist and the fingers and a slight bit of extension just to make sure that you have some redundancy. And I put the fingers out and then obviously check it after after doing it.
Excellent. That's awesome. So talk a little bit briefly about your postoperative protocol and what you tell the patient.
So I told them what we found, obviously. The ultrasound helped because in the pre-op area, I told them, I think that this is what's going on. So everybody and patient's family was there. So everybody's kind of aware of what the possibility was. We're going to have to follow this over time. I do protect the wrist in terms of extension for the first 3 weeks. So this was a dorsal blocking, splint. Based on the dorsal forearm and wrist so that they can't extend and fingers are free though. Because I think that's super useful in terms of, you know, avoiding stiffness, et cetera. I'll protect it for 3 weeks. And then from there, do some gentle active extension, no aggressive passive extension for an additional 3 weeks.
And you tell him to expect normal 2-point discrimination in...
Oh, hell no. Are you kidding me? Well, I mean, you know, I think that it's one of those things where you're hoping to just get rid of the pain. Fortunately for him, of any portion of the median nerve to injure, this is the one because people use their web space as a donor for a nerve transfer. And then I should mention that during the surgery, the radial side looked good. We took out the checkpoint. I was super sure that the recurrent motor branch was on the radial side, nothing funny going on in terms of anatomy. And I honestly just wanted to have another video of using the stimulator for recurrent motor branch. And you will rest easy that we did isolate the palmar cutaneous branch of the median nerve and it was okay. I know you were losing sleep over that one.
Be deep exhale. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that critical version. Well, you know, I do like learning and talking about nerve. Must have been a great session. Thanks for sharing the case.
Well, yeah. I mean, it worked out that you weren't there because then you would have known all the answers. So it worked out pretty well. But have a good day.
All right. Great to see you. You too. Glad you got around early for the team.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
Hey, Chris, that was fun. Let's do it again real soon.
Sounds good. Well, be sure to check us out on Twitter at Hand Podcast. Hey, Chuck, what's your Twitter handle?
Mine is at Congenital Hand. What about you?
Mine is at Chris DMD, spelled DY. And if you'd like to email us, you can reach us at handpodcast@gmail.com.
And remember, please subscribe wherever you get your podcast.
And be sure to leave a review. That helps us get the word out.
Special thanks to Peter Martin for the amazing music. And remember, keep the upper hand and come back next time.